I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/Inner Academy.
Hello and welcome to the Shakti Hour, a podcast on Ram Dass's Be Here Now Network. I'm your host, Melanie Moser, and today I'm sharing a conversation with Vicky Noble, the co-creator of the Mother Peace Tarot Deck and author of several books, including Shakti Woman and The Double Goddess. I had a really great time talking to Vicky, and I really want to talk to her again and get into some more specifics with her. She has so much wisdom on the divine feminine, on Shakti, on the double goddess, on the dark goddess, on matriarchal systems. She's so wise, very fun, and just did a collaboration with Christian Dior on her Mother Peace Tarot artwork, and they did this really cool collection of jackets and dresses featuring the artwork that came out in the end of 2017. So definitely check that out. Enjoy this conversation and go to VickyNoble.com or to the Shakti Hour page to find links to purchase Vicky's books and to play with the Mother Peace Tarot. She did pull a card for the Shakti Hour itself. At the end, she shares that and reveals what the card of this podcast is, which was pretty cool. Thank you so much for listening to the Shakti Hour. You can, of course, subscribe on iTunes and leave us a rating and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Shakti Hour and on Instagram, Meditate with Melanie and the Shakti Hour podcast. Thanks so much for listening, and now enjoy this conversation with Vicky Noble. Your body of work is just, you know, really, we could do a whole, you know, at least 6 months of Shakti Hour series on your body of work. Yes, basically on your body of work around the feminine and around Shakti and around the goddess and you know, all these different things, but I guess I wanted to maybe start by just digging in a little bit to this idea of matriarchal consciousness that you have written about, and maybe you could share with us how you came to that understanding and how that's maybe evolved for you.
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. It's sort of like my whole life, my whole career life. So first of all, just to clarify, the word matriarchy has been so really, I think, deliberately misunderstood. And there's a kind of a resistance to understanding what it actually means and what it actually points to. People prefer, in my experience, to imagine that it means the opposite of patriarchy. So it means not the opposite, but the flip side, as if women dominating is the meaning. It doesn't mean anything like that. There's never been a culture that we know of where women dominated men. And so that's what the anthropologists always say. There's never been a culture where women dominated men, so therefore you can't use the word matriarchy. There's never been one, there can't be one. And we say matriarchy, when you break it down linguistically, means beginning with the mother. Mother beginning, or beginning with the mothers. And so it's evolutionary, you know. We know now that we all come out of Africa, that we have an ancestral dark mother. That's what Lucia Birnbaum, do you know her work? Lucia Chiavella Birnbaum.
Yeah.
She talked about the African dark mother and that being our essential ancestry. So we share that. Everybody came out of Africa. We all share a matriarchal beginning. The original unit, family unit, you could call it, is the mother and child. I mean, it's so fundamental. It always seems silly in a way to talk about it because it's so simple and biological and really not very debatable. The mother-child unit is original. From there, other offspring, siblings, everybody belongs to the same mother line. So the mother and daughter is often how we talk about matriarchy because it's matrilineal. But it's mothers and daughters and sons. And it's mothers' brothers, you know, who function in the role of the social father, you might say. So biological fatherhood is something I think people knew perfectly well since forever about biological fatherhood, but they didn't institutionalize it. In matriarchy, it doesn't generally make very much difference. The cultures are organized around the household of the mother. Usually you could think of it in terms of an extended family where mothers and daughters are in the center. Mothers, you know, mothers have children. All the children are part of the family. There's no possibility of having an illegitimate child because paternity has nothing to do with anything. And so that's very challenging for us in the West, but it's so simple in its actual presentation. And some of the feminist anthropologists have told us that even in the very beginning of our hunter-gatherer existence, when we came down out of the trees, you know, and differentiated ourselves as human and stood upright and had menstruation, which is unique to our species. All of that, when that happened, had mothers at the center in terms of creating social units. So this is all anthropological stuff. And but I bring it in because we're looking today in the matriarchal studies movement, we're looking at living matriarchal cultures. I think of them as little remnants of what was always the situation until about 5,000 years ago. Patriarchy is very strange. It's an aberration, or at least it's a detour. You know, it's a switch of some kind. And it with patriarchy comes social stratification, class stratification, centralized government, the rise of the state, slavery, domination, all those things. And before that, those things don't exist. And in some contemporary matriarchal cultures, the Moso in China, for example, or who else, the Khasi in India, for a long time, probably now it's a little different, but for a long time in their uncorrupted state, they didn't even have words for rape. You know, they didn't even have a concept of male violence toward women in that way. Often, actually, the Moso in China had no concept or no word for husband, no word for father, because it was not relevant. those were not institutionalized roles.
I just heard there was just a reporting from on the BBC from a woman, a businesswoman in China who had gone to, who had abandoned her life and gone to live with the Mosso.
And was
sharing about that, how the man would just come to the mother's house and then leave.
Well, and it's more interesting than that. The girls get their periods, so around 13 or so, they are given their own rooms. So it's called her flower room. And they then are free to entertain boys and then men, you know, as they wish. The boys live in their mother's similar compounds, and they come in the night and visit their girlfriends, their lovers, their partners, and they go back in the morning, and all their productive work goes into the mother's household. And same for the girls. They live in the mother's larger compound, and there's no economic connection to sexuality. So in no way are the relationships dependent economically, which is incredible. Imagine.
Right. So that's the threat. That's the threat to current society.
Absolutely.
I know there was a Steve Bannon a while ago was writing this, you know, doomsday post in the world, you know, we don't want that. And,
quite afraid, you know, that we'll turn around and do them what they've done to us. There's a big worry, whether it's consciously expressed or unconsciously held, you know, that women will get revenge.
Is it really that? Is it that the men think that if we took power, we would do to them what they had done to us? Is that what that is? Or what is the powerful? Yeah,
I think so. I mean, there've even been, actually there was a novel I read recently called The Power, written by a woman, quite a good story, in which she posited that women got, through some force, I can't remember, got some special forces, some special abilities, sort of psychic abilities, but more like sort of sci-fi, you know, like abilities to do move powerful things. The story was then how women took revenge, got really mean and, you know, basically wielded power the way men have wielded power.
Right. And that's so how Me Too is playing out right now. It's playing out in this powerful, you hurt me, so now we're taking your career, which is not what we're talking about when we're talking about a matriarchal society.
That's right.
But do you think that this is some sort of, this is a necessary balancing, or do you think that we would be better served just embodying this matriarchal consciousness?
Well, that we can't get there from here without a process.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking about that myself this week, because in some ways, the beginning of the Me Too movement was exhilarating, I have to say. Watching powerful men fall from places where they've abused power. I thought it had a lot to do with Pluto in Capricorn. Pluto's in the last 10 degrees of the sign of Capricorn now. And it's a lot about falling from power if you've abused power. So I think, and for women, Pluto often functions in a very empowering way. So as an astrologer, I see it as right on time, you know, And I felt that in the beginning, it was, as I say, I felt exhilarated, like, yes, it's about time. And what an incredible phenomenon that suddenly it's actually not okay anymore for men to behave like that. And it's not okay for everybody to act like it's not happening. And so everybody's culpable, which is kind of frightening. And and the thing that's been happening in Virginia, I guess it is, this week, get rid of the thing, is kind of unnerving. as some of them have been all along, where you just feel like, well, there are these gradations, and it's not all the same, you know, and a lot of people have already said that. That's not new. But I right. do think that's what we're seeing is a kind of, I'm sure this probably happens with all movements in the beginning, where as it popularizes or as it takes shape and comes into the mainstream, where it's not just, you know, some radical idea, but actually becomes embodied in mainstream culture, I do think there's always a kind of fanaticism that can happen. We're always in danger of that. As a very young feminist who came out as a feminist, you know, when I was 22 or something, I remember how generalized it was for me. I remember how much trouble I gave my professors at, when I went back to get my BA at Colorado College. And they were so kind. They were so really quite spacious with me. I would say, I'm not reading Thucydides. It's just a bunch of lies. I'm not reading it. And my classics professor said, okay, read something else and write me a paper. You know, they were really, it was really, it was me. I was so, it was a hair trigger, you know, I just.
Well, but don't, you know, it doesn't, don't you think like from this matriarchal, from the, in a patriarchal society, there is that the vulnerability of the feminine, you know, thinking of a pregnant woman or a newborn, a woman with like, really what you have is your voice. You know, you're vulnerable in this physical level. So on a certain degree, the gradations are only relevant in a seat of particular power, right? So, right? So, you know, like, so sitting here, you and I sitting here can in this moment where, you know, we both are in our individual lives, can look at those different things. But in another moment in our lives as women, the voice to say, no, you can't even do that because I can't take it. Like, it's going to injure me.
Uh-huh. Well, and that's certainly a battle that feminist women have fought in their relationship lives. I mean, I think that's really true where you're kind of a purist, you know, if we're going to be equal, we're going to have to be equal. And these little microaggressions as the, what is that? As the jargon goes these days, those matter, you know, just the tiniest breach of whatever contracts you're making with a male partner, for example, can be upsetting enough, can be a deal breaker. If you're really, you know, I felt in my own relationships over the course of my life that I am actually not able to be dominated. It's not possible for me. I think once you're awake to that, you know, that every little nuance of behavior and feeling and everything is noticeable, and you're always weighing it. So in a way, I just feel like we're probably going to go too far with the Me Too movement in many people's minds, but it probably isn't going too far because hopefully it won't go so far that the backlash that comes down on it is worse than what we've endured before. But, you know, as a 71-year-old feminist who's been a feminist for 50 years, I feel like, you know, it is about time. I mean, really, it's ridiculous. You know,
well, and even in my own mind, throughout the course of the movement, which honestly, this is the first time it's come up on the Shakti Hour, which is hilarious. But it's unbelievable to me the things that then became unacceptable in my own mind that I had endured, or things that I had written as one story. Then it was revealed to me as something that really was an act against my my humanity beyond my, you know, femaleness. And so I do think that there is, like you said, that there is, and also then this leads to the other piece of your work that's, you know, foundational, the dark goddess. There is this yes. like there is the depth that I think is also part of what's being explored within the individual woman, and also then through this movement is like, well, but this goes really deep. Like,
yes,
I could
5,000 years.
Yes,
5,000. We used to say, I had a poster that had I can't remember the picture, but it said, "Your 5,000 years are up." You know, and that was in the 1970s. And here we are in the 2000s, and,
right.
you know, we're still working on the same
right.
vision.
Right. So what can you tell us about that time period then, as you've seen this evolution of consciousness around, you know, the feminine and the point of view of the mother and the goddess.
Well, that's very apropos of your show name, because what I often spend time trying to explain or maybe bring out the feeling of is the joy and the freedom that we felt in the 1970s. It was so exhilarating. The option to quit patriarchy in some sense, you know, the awakening of a feminist paradigm was so amazing.
Well, you know, it's so interesting to me because one of the great gifts of being a part of the Ram Dass community is that I do get to spend time with people from different generations, which I think is, and I get to spend time with, and I've gotten to know and talk with several of you that were there, right? You
know? Yeah.
And it is very, very different. It's
yes.
very, very different that because you, like you, and I think I love that you brought up Shakti as a part of it, because it really does seem to me that you were all kind of steeped in this energy. Like it was uh-huh. not only LSD and...
No.
And trips to the East and feminism and whatever. It was not all only those things. There was definitely an energetic
yeah.
shift that was yeah. happening. And I spoke with Ram Dass about it a little bit last year, and we were just talking about how now it's almost like the possibility for awakening is greater, but there's less support for it. So energetically, there's like more like possibility to see things a different way, but less of the foundational structure. And I think that that's something that kind of, you know, that lends to the mythology of the 60s and 70s, because you were sprouting on such solid ground. I mean, the contrast between the status quo and what you were creating was quite
yeah.
great, right? Yeah.
The world culture in some way was open to what we were bringing.
Right.
That's true in the civil rights movement. It's true in the in any of the movements, but certainly in the women's movement. There was an openness, you know, it somehow wasn't as threatening to most of the culture. Of course, there is that element of radical conservative Christianity and so on. And that element went into very focused backlash, very focused, very intelligent organization for over the next decade until they actually were able to turn it around. Which has been sort of educational, because I think we weren't really paying attention. We were riding a wave of tremendous success and exhilaration and possibility. Anything was possible, which is just, you know, not true anymore. And with the fall of the inability to pass the Equal Rights Amendment, that was a very concerted effort on the part of right-wing women. There was a right-wing women's movement, you know, and it was very focused and has been ultimately quite successful. And I think that's some kind of a lesson because, you know, Shakti, it's all about a kind of wonderful, spontaneous creativity, a sort of endless source of energy and creativity. And creatives aren't always paying attention to long-term need for focus and for focused goals and so on. And I think we got the rug pulled out from under us on account of that, or maybe it's just impossible. I look at Democrats and Republicans even that way, that it's awfully hard. Democrats are intellectual and they talk about everything and they parse it all out, and it's great, you know, it's such a good analysis, but we don't have very good focus because we're kind of creative and spontaneous and moving on and interested in a lot of things. And the Republicans have this tremendous long-term goal kind of focus. They've been focusing for all these years. How long ago? It's almost, you know, it's almost 50 years. They're still focusing on getting rid of Roe versus Wade. Right. It's just one issue.
Right.
But they never leave off of it.
Right. Well, and it also is so linked to religion. Right.
Yes, because, exactly.
Because then, you know, what is life and when does life begin and end? And that has to do with Shakti and creativity. And so it seems like, but, you know, so, but
it has,
but,
to, do with, has to do with Kali.
Well, it has to do with Kali, but it also, I mean, but she consumes whatever we throw at her, though. No, I mean, is she discriminating about what she consumes? You know, Kali, was she discriminating if we throw Roe v. Wade at her, or if we throw, you know, like, what is she?
I guess what I mean when I say the dark goddess or the black Dakini, my Yidam, or Kali, is that in the goddess religion, which I guess to backtrack a little bit, you know, that's what we did in the 70s, a lot of us. We not only left our husbands and heteronormative patriarchy, we left the culture in many ways. We left our churches and our synagogues and so on. And we created a new religion, a new old religion, you know, borrowing from what we could see and understand of ancient times. And we did that individually in a way as part of a movement that was taking shape that none of us were aware of until it took shape, you know.
Right.
And so there was this tremendous collective impulse to say no to the idea that God is a white man living in heaven, you know, and that he's judgmental and violent. We said, no, that doesn't make any sense to us, and left that entirely behind, and left you know, left so many things behind. Even economically, so many radical feminist spiritual women went to the country, lived in collectives, you know, and so on. So the wave of resistance has partly been successful because it has erased that history. We do that in capitalism anyway, but the history of that decade of the 70s has more or less been erased. The lesbian separatist movement, you know, that was so juicy at the time, has been perceived and depicted as prudish and non-sexual and things like that. You know, there's just wildly misconstrued pictures and depictions of what feminism is, what radical feminists were and are. All of that is so nicely erased through the powerful industry that puts out images and produces stories in our culture. And that machine that constantly and so effectively puts out those negative messages about women and feminism and our history and what has gone before. It makes the next generation of women feel that it's sort of out of fashion. And that really gets us in America. We don't want to be out of step. You know, we like to be current. And I think we have an enormous value we put on that. And so to be out of step with what's fashionable is impossible. You know, we can't stand it. And so that's been very effective. And it's a hard story to come up against. Because, and so that's what I think has possessed me over the decades, you know, to keep trying to bring that feeling of that time period back, to try to remind people what Shakti looks like, you know, what does it look like when a whole culture awakens to its own potential or its own energetic, creative possibilities? When each woman, you know, waking up to the idea that, no, I don't actually have to do this. I don't have to be anybody's secondary. I don't have to be in this role where I'm not myself. I can actually explore all possibilities. It was thrilling, you know, it was thrilling. It's very enlivening. And we need somehow to find that again. And I think in the Me Too movement, there's probably some of that going on. The collectivity, the sisterhood, the solidarity with other women so that you can actually speak your experience and not be denied that experience is so empowering that it probably, you know, it's likely to go a little overboard. We always probably are likely to go a little overboard, I'd say, in any movement.
Right. Well, you know, but just in your sharing of that, your passionate sharing of your dedication to bringing that Shakti experience to people, you know, I get that feeling from you. But part of what you're saying about it is that there was this joy and there was this this like awakening and a joy and a liberation, and I wonder about that these days, and I have this great reverence, I would say, for Jacinda Ardern, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, in the way that she seems to be leading, has a lightness and a femininity and a joy to it, while it's still kind of just throwing out all of this garbage, literally, like no plastic bags, no fracking in the oceans, like, you know, very, very much, but doing it in a way and being pregnant, giving birth while in office, you know, all of these kinds of,
Really, beautiful. I don't know all this.
Oh, you must check her out. She's fabulous. Yeah, the current Prime Minister of New Zealand, and I feel that she's an expression of that. In power.
I think it was.
Yeah,
I think it was also true in Iceland.
Yeah,
you know, the women came into governing power and everything worked out. And before that, it was really a mess.
Right.
And it was very light, but at least as much as I know about it, it seemed very lighthearted and also in solidarity, women working together. Because it's never just one woman. You know, Hillary Clinton wouldn't really have made that big of a difference, even though I wish it had happened. It takes much more than one woman. Because one woman in a male role, you know, it's kind of doomed. But half the people in the room being women, now that is powerful. Because women have, you know, oxytocin, the hormone oxytocin. The more of us get together trying to do something beneficial, the more oxytocin is generated. The more oxytocin is generated, the more male testosterone kind of dials down a little bit, because it's a certain kind of comfort zone for men and women to be immersed in oxytocin. So I'm all into the science now.
Yeah, you know, I think that that's another piece of this moment too, is, you know, the individual and the group, and that with the rise of feminism and the capacity to do and be whatever we can to do and be, I've run into some resistance with some younger women who are wanting to just, they want to try their hand at the game as it stands, you know?
Yeah.
They want to get out.
Why
can't I go for the thing, you know, the way that I want to, the way that the game is, I can play the game the way that it is out there. And I don't want to give that up.
Well, I think that happened to more than just women. I think that actually is a little bit of an explanation of what happened in general with movements for, you know, for environmental reform and so on. If we really meant it, we would have to give up so much. The cars we drive, the everything, so many things. We have to, you know, give up some things. We have to sacrifice some things if we want to keep the planet alive. And I think that's very difficult, of course, for anybody. And I think that as a group, we kind of went for the capitalist dream. You know, we kind of reached for the gold ring. I remember Jackson Brown's beautiful song, After the Deluge, where he basically said that he described the dropping out back to the land movement and then reaching for the gold ring. I'll never forget those words, because I fear that we have traded our, you know, we've traded the values, I guess. I'm looking for some word that isn't quite that, vision, values.
It's the integrity. It's like the heart, yeah. The heart of it is,
yeah.
Is,
we couldn't bring ourselves to really do what was necessary, you know, so we've caved in, and here we are going over the cliff.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Why do you think that is? Is that human nature, or is that specific to,
I think it's
specific spiritual awakening or?
No, I don't. I think it's specific to capitalism. I think capitalism is a really underestimated force. You know, that really it's almost unstoppable.
When you're in your 20s and abandoning your lives and going to start a cooperative farm and then then your kids become teenagers and want to go to college and you're a bit older, or maybe there's a health problem, then potentially these things look less inviting to be the bottom line or something.
And also just the way that this must, I don't know, I'm not an economist, so I really can't speak to this in an expert way, but the fact, one of the facts about the 70s that made it so exhilarating was that it took very little money to live. You know, when Karen Vogel and I moved to Berkeley in 1976 and began our project that turned into the Mother Peace Cards that came out 5 years later in 81, it was possible to live on almost nothing. We had my child support. We had a little stipend from her mother. She had saved, you know, $10,000 from something. And so we went to buy a house, a 5-bedroom house in the Berkeley Flats. And it was easy. You know, somebody sent us to the credit union. We talked to a loan officer. We said, we have BAs, we have degrees, but we don't want to have jobs because we're writing a book. So don't worry, we'll pay our mortgage. And he said, okay, sign here. You know, that would never, ever happen again. That was a moment in time that was so, it was so supportive. So we actually were able to move into this house and live there during the whole time that we made the Mother Peace Project without any other income, only what we had from these, small, stable sources. And in that period of time, we didn't have a car. We walked everywhere, took public transportation, made my kids, my unhappy teenagers, do the same thing. It was just, but what happened during that period, the fate that helped us so much in the Mother Peace Project, housing market tripled in that 5-year period. And our house was worth enough to get a second mortgage and publish the cards, print the cards. And the cards, of course, made my whole career. So, it was a particular moment in history. My students ask me now, what can we do, to find right livelihood? I say anything you can find. Mm. It's such a different time. Mm. You can't just drop out like we did. Mm. It takes so much money to live in California.
Right. I mean, maybe that's this, instead of these, great philanthropic efforts to, get healthcare, these are wonderful efforts, but make, healthcare app that delivers supplies to the middle of nowhere. It mm-hmm. might be worth it to consider this very basic thing that you're saying of housing,
Yeah.
And then back to matriarchal consciousness, of course, that's the first thing that a mother would think of, is that we need a safe and warm and good place for the family to be, to live, to have our home. Yes. When that is taken care of and we have nourishing food, we can do anything. We can put our values yes. first. And so this
everyone needs to have the same. That's the beauty of a collective consciousness, is that it doesn't have to be controlled by some centralized state government that turns into the Soviet Union. It just is a kind of natural gift economy where you whatever resources the community shares, they share equally. They distribute equally. And it was women in leadership in those cultures that made that happen. And we have that past in European descent, and the indigenous cultures all over the world practice it. It's pretty simple.
Yeah, I know. Winona LaDuke has an economics degree from MIT, but she speaks about how she's focused on that indigenous culture, the economics of her people and the people that are in her area, and making sure that everyone that's there has what they need, as opposed to thinking on these grander scales, which are also very, very exciting and interesting. But so, with that, you did just do this partnership with Dior with the tarot, and I'm kind of it's kind of all kind of flowing together to kind of culminate around this. How did that come about, and what was that like for you?
It was a dream. It was fantastic. And in a certain way, I have to say, really personally for me, it was such a profound affirmation of the work I've done in my life. It was such a profound affirmation that isn't coming to me right now from the publishing industry, for example. They're not that interested. And, there are just so many ways that I've lived on the edge most of my life in terms of economics and all that. And it's been fine. I chose that, but it was remarkable to have someone value the work that Karen and I did after all these years, to value it on that level. It was thrilling. And in a certain way, it was like, I to use a football term, which I don't even watch football, but it was like an end run, that concept around the publishing industry, because it's hard. I've been pretty upset about not being able to get a book published for quite a while without completely changing my values, and so this was just a direct connection, a direct affirmation, And the way it happened was magical from beginning to end. They contacted me the night before my 70th birthday. I thought it was a joke. I thought it was, you know, there's so much spam. I just thought it was something like that. But it wasn't. It was, it all came about through some, you know, windy road of karma. I have all this karma that I don't really understand in Italy. I've been teaching in Italy for the last 12 years, often twice a year. And so I have many, many, many women students there, and they've translated and published my books. So I almost all of my books are published there. And Maria Grazia Curie was put in place a couple of years ago as the first woman ever to be artistic director at Christian Dior. And the first thing she did was to make a campaign based on an African woman's phrase, we should all be feminists. Her name is Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, and she's wonderful and has written a little, it was a TED talk that she turned into a little book, which I had read, we should all be feminists. And I had used the words on my collages that I do with my students. And so so she read my book in Italian and found and loved it and made it part of the vision of her show, her clothing line, and loved the mother piece images. She already had a, you know, she had a predilection toward the Tarot, and so did Christian Dior, apparently, according to her. And so all of that came together, you know, in this just completely, it was such a creative event. I felt that the message to me was relax, you know, kind of step back. Don't try to mastermind everything because the universe is so much more creative. Like yeah. I never would have dreamed that up, you know?
Right.
And it has been wonderful. Working with her, working with them, they made the most beautiful images. I mean, most beautiful dresses out of our images, featuring our images. Really, it was so profound. And we're kind of still in it, but it's almost over. That's how fashion is, you know?
Yeah, it goes pretty quick. But then it becomes another legacy, of those images and another inroad into, yes, into your work and into your tarot. And
yes.
I'm curious about your reflections then on tarot, as it has become actually very mainstream or more mainstream in the last few years. It's something that people have embraced or have started to incorporate in their spirituality or something. How do you feel about that?
I feel great about it because what I have experienced in the last couple of years is all the young women who are using the mother piece and who have been using it for a while. Their mothers gave them the decks in many cases, you know? And so it's like it skipped a generation, maybe. Maria Grazia Curie is around the age of my two daughters. So she's like a woman who grew up to be a feminist and really stands strong in that. So it's thrilling. I love that because that generation of my daughters didn't really do that for a long time. You know, that...
But there are some pitfalls with tarot. I mean, I wouldn't put that on the mother piece deck per se, but there are some pitfalls with the tarot, or maybe there's not. Maybe.
Well, what do you mean?
Well, in the, you know, actually, I saw a post come through my Instagram the other day. Someone posted this meme that said, you know, date someone who doesn't make you check the tarot every 15 minutes.
Said that about a woman, you mean?
No, a woman was saying that about a man, like, you know, because of the use. I interpreted it as the use of the desire to predict or to control or insecurity or some lower vibration instinct to grab.
It's like a misunderstanding of how oracles are used, I think.
So give us a clear read on how to do that.
Yeah. I'll say two things in relation to your comment. One is that I'm remembering now that, of course, when the Mother piece came out, the tarot community hardly related to it at all. And in fact, hardly ever have over the years. So once some newspaper or somebody called me to do an interview about the tarot, and for just a minute, I didn't know what they were talking about. Like, why me? Because Mother piece is so different. And so that's the first thing that I think it's really important to say, is that it truly is a different, it's a bifurcation of some kind. I mean, we revisioned the tarot in a way that hasn't really been acceptable to the tarot establishment. Okay, so having said that, the thing that has always happened with Mother piece is that it has actually led women into the tarot. They've told me many times that they used to be afraid of it. It was dark. They didn't want to get involved. And then they found the Mother piece. And we made the Mother piece exactly with that in mind. We were in a phase of great transformation, me and Karen, in the late 70s. Tremendous spiritual transformation. And we were, but it had a feminist center. So that's our lens. And so what we were aware of was using psychic methods and healing methods to cleanse ourselves of the imagery, particularly the imagery of patriarchy. To get those, we felt that those images had been implanted in us, all women, from in the womb, and that we had to do something very dramatic to get them out and keep them out. The negative images of the feminine, you might say, the prescribed roles and all that. And so we learned in our psychic classes and so on that you can't just remove an image or cut a cord or any of those psychic techniques without replacing it with something beautiful, something that you choose, something that produces joy instead of harm. And so that we were coming from that place when we started to make the Mother piece images. It was all about healing. And I was coming from some kind of incredible shamanic awakening that had happened, and many kundalini experiences, many things I didn't understand fully at the time, but they were happening and they were very sacred. And it was a kind of a context where I was awakening and transforming very quickly and understanding that it was possible. I figured if it was possible for me, it was possible for any woman. Now I understand a little better about karma and past lives and what we come in with and all those more mystical aspects of the work. But at the time, I just felt like if I can grow up in Iowa with no intellectual background whatsoever and move to California and have this brilliant awakening, anybody can. Hmm. And that was my basic approach in my teaching for a
right.
long time.
So your experience of the tarot was very personal, and it was this healing, transformational expression of
devotional. It was really the mother goddess, or whatever you want to call it,
right?
The whole relationship of female deity,
right.
and that completely permeates the Mother piece cards without it being necessary to be religious about it. It can be fun. You can pull the Mother piece cards out at a party and have fun. It's not, there's nothing in it that's going to take you down to a dark place, or I don't know how to, the language, but.
Well, but it's been transmuted through your own process. So, I think that as a creator versus a practitioner, that there's something to that, in that you created that and had that alchemical experience through through the manifestation of this tarot deck that other people can then draw from.
Yes, you know, and that transmits, you know, as you know, those kinds of energies for any artist, I think, doing any kind of spiritual work. You're transmitting something. And when somebody picks up our deck, it's a transmission. It's not just visual. There's something coming through.
Right. So you have created this capsule of that possibility, that joy, that moment that, that you're hoping to impart to all of us. And it, now it's coming through in this new fashion line. And what is it that you're working on next? Like, what is it that you are currently putting your energy into?
I'm working on a couple of different projects, a book project with two friends that comes to mind, because I was just in Southern California working on it. It's a project that has to do, it's focused on the Indus Valley, you know, ancient India before the Vedas and all that. But really, it's turning out to be much more than that, like everything always does. And it's so much our own, we're coming at it from three different angles, but we're really trying to, again, bring forth, make real, bring alive the reality that we all live inside of another way of being, this matriarchal way of being, this feminine way of being. People are more comfortable with feminine, but it's all of that. You know, there's a whole other way of being that it includes empathy and integrity and ethics and love and joy and connection and bonding, and we're actually doing a history project, you might say, that allows us to bring that philosophical lens through what we see in old Europe, the goddess civilizations of old Europe, and the work of Maria Gimbutas, which has now just recently been vindicated. The DNA research that's come out recently, fantastic. It's made her right. And so the archaeological establishment has to deal with it. And we love that. And so we're bringing some of that. And we're making very vast connections across Afro-Eurasia, which I did already do in my Double Goddess book that came out in 2003. I'm all about those big connections over time between East and West. And the women behind it that underpin the whole culture, the whole cultural connection, women in shamanism, women in spiritual leadership, even all the way up to the time of Christianity. So I'd like lots of thousands of years.
Well, that just sounds amazing. I mean, I'm just so super grateful for all of your work and your continued enthusiasm to explore these things, and I feel like I feel like we need to seriously consider doing a bit of a series, because I want to dig deeper into more of these topics that we just glanced over now. But given your your depth of practice in from different, so many different angles, and your wisdom across traditions, what quick piece of advice would you give to women and girls on the spiritual path?
Well, you know, from the beginning, when I did the mother piece with Karen, till now, when I'm adapting these Tibetan Buddhist practices for women, I always am really looking for the same outcome. I want women not only to have their intuition, we're allowed that in our culture. Women are said to be more intuitive and so on. So we get to have it, but we rarely get to act on it. The culture doesn't like it when we tell the truth, doesn't like it when we say what we see when we, if it disagrees in any way with what's happening. And so I feel whatever tools a woman can use to help her ground herself in the deep feminine, whatever she can do, whether it's Dakini practices or the Mother Peace Tarot or some other form of spiritual guidance or spiritual direction, what needs to happen is that all women, all of us, need to overcome our socialization, which has ungrounded us from our own deep central axis. And we need to find some way of moving back to the center of our own mandala, to the center of our own reality, and that we need to be able to act from that deep connection to what is real for us, to what we know in our hearts. And once we can do that, we can make progress.
So that is great. So that knowing, so what can you advise on how to act on that knowing? So if you get access to the knowing, what are some tools or ways to act on it?
Well, for me, it's always been, since I've been a healer since the 1970s, it's a lot about the energetics. I think that energetically, I mean, I know it's about embodiment. So we have to have exercise and we have to have yoga and we have to have ways of coming back into our bodies and being in the center of that consciousness. So physical things, yes. But we also need energetic ways, psychic ways. We need to change our psychic structure. And it takes time. You do it over time. And you can do it in the simplest way. The Mother Peace has always been a way to do that for a woman. If she looks at the cards every day, it's not about predicting the future. It's about looking at what's actually happening right now. So you can do that through all oracles, I think, where you can, you get the truth, you know, okay, what's true here? Am I seeing something that I need to act on, or am I just afraid, or am I, you know, having a fantasy? And the oracles will mirror back to you what's true, and you'll feel it and acknowledge it in your body. We need more of that. We need a lot of that. We need a sort of continuous practice of that.
Well, and as you're saying that too, that continuous practice, it even is the initial part, and that psychic, the energetic and the psychic part is the practice of, is that true? Is this, am I knowing this? Is this my knowing?
Yes.
That can even be the first action before even taking it into the material plane, is that practice of reflecting it back to yourself and coming into that confidence, that energetic vibrational confidence around that can be a thing. And I love that the use of images, and specifically the Mother Peace Tarot, and but even just reflecting through different images and different ways of using the practice of oracle can be a way of strengthening that own, your own knowing. I mean, I definitely have used that through the practice of Guru Kripa, practicing with my guru. That's definitely kind of part of that, you know.
Yes.
Reflecting
Guru
to
yoga.
Him. Yeah. Huh? Reflecting to him. And then I'll also use that with, I use texts, but I haven't used it as much in imagery. And I'm going to, I'm always looking for the meaning behind the image. And I like that you're offering that I can just use that reflection, that image, the image reflective. And then I can dig deeper into the meaning if I need to, but to just stop even with the image, knowing now how deep the cultivation was in order to create the images that you have created. Mm. It reminds me of the, you know, the power of art, you know, the power of looking at art.
Yes. You know, there's a wonderful new book, Victoria Christensen is the editor who put this together. It's a lovely, big, beautiful anthology. It's called, I can't remember the exact title, but it's beautiful art of the feminine divine, basically. Mostly women artists, some men, and quite a tremendous variety of images. I have an essay in there about the Dakini tradition and the Dakini practices, but there's every kind of expression of the divine feminine in art. The title is something like that, but look up Victoria Christensen. It's just really a beautiful book.
That sounds like a great place to use as an oracle. Well, we ought to close here, but maybe would it make sense to pull a card for the Shakti Hour?
Absolutely. It's kind of an Amazon card there. The Chariot, the Major Arcana number 7.
Beautiful.
Yeah, so that has a lot to do with being in the real world and accomplishing your goals. And in a secret, sort of more esoteric way, it has to do with the adept, the practitioner, the aspirant, passing the test, doing the job, accomplishing the task, winning her way.
Well, that definitely suits my experience of this podcast so far. Well, Vicky, I honestly would love to keep this going, but I really feel so deeply connected to everything you're saying, and I really want to explore more with you in some way.
That.
Yeah, either here or in another medium. But I highly recommend that all of you listening go to the Shakti Hour page at BeHereNowNetwork.com, where we'll have links to purchase all of Vicky's books and also link to her website. And what is, do you want to say it now just so we have it here, audio?
Yeah, VickyNoble.com.
VickyNoble.com. It's real simple. She got in on those domains at the beginning. And and you can find out all of her upcoming events and links to everything that she has to offer you. And thank you so much, Vicky, for your time and for sharing all of your wonderful wisdom.
Thank you, Melanie. It's really been a pleasure. I look forward to more.